This is HPR episode 2849 entitled, HPR NYE Show 2018-2019 Part 5. It is hosted by Honky Magu, and is about 129 minutes long, and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, the HPR community comes together to say Happy New Year, and chat.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by Archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Well, I don't know how well my audio is. I don't have anyone to test against. But I wanted to jump on here and talk about the, see if anyone else around here has been participating in the Sans Holiday Hack Challenge this year.
I'd like to hear about the challenge. I haven't been participating, but I'd certainly like to hear someone who knows more about it.
So every year, Sans puts on this annual holiday challenge for people that are cybersecurity enthusiasts and like playing around with their Kali Linux distros. And so like last year their challenge was it's a multi-part type of challenge for like last year's. They had like a physics game where you had to roll snowballs to be able to get clues from different types of elves. Because it's all Christmas themed, right? So you're kind of up at the North Pole helping Santa out, and the elves help you out, giving you hints. So you do terminal challenges throughout the game where you collect more hints, and some of them are, this process won't start. What's preventing it from starting, or, I can't get something to run on my Linux thing. Can you help me out? And the elves are very thankful, so they give you hints and whatnot for the bigger challenges. So to start off on your bigger challenges, the clues they gave you was about like the Equifax hack from 2017, and you actually ended up using that same Apache Struts attack on one of their machines that they set up. So they intentionally made their machine vulnerable, a real-life machine out there where everyone is getting into it through that Apache Struts vuln and creating persistence on that machine. And you had to set up your SSH session, but you had to learn. And it's all about learning throughout the entire thing. They're not expecting you to know the stuff, so that's why they give out plenty of hints. So you had to learn how to set up the SSH session so your port connection to, that box would become your pivot. So you could pivot through that box out one side through the other to the rest of their network, because that Apache Struts box had that one exploit on it, but they didn't have any other type of binaries on the system for you to be able to use to continue your attack. So you actually had to use the binaries on your own system to run the rest of your attacks throughout the rest of their network. So that was kind of what got me hooked on it last year, was being able to run an attack like that. A lot of red team type of scenarios. But this year's stuff is a lot more blue team. You have to read PCAP files and analyze them to see where traffic is, and from that traffic create rules for your snort machine, to prevent or not prevent, but to like alert certain types of traffic that you want to see when it comes across your network. A lot of little different hacky stuff, and kind of got me started down the path of trying to do the hacker stuff, you know. But I think the guys that created are part of a company called CounterHack. And they got their own website, but the Sands Holiday Hack Challenge is what the main site for where everything's happening. You can even still do last year's challenges and everything, and they have write-ups, you know, in case, you know, if you get, so you can kind of see what you're doing. But right now we're in week, we just started week three of the Hack Challenge. And we still got a couple more weeks to go. They kind of give out a couple grand prizes, you know, they give out a free Sands course, you know, to like their top winner, and, you know, t-shirts and whatnot for other people, you know, that put a good effort forward. Because you can, I guess I didn't even say how you win or how you compete to win, is you actually have to put together your documentation skills and document everything that you've done the entire way and submit that to them, and they read through it. I think last year, the grand prize winner actually put together an entire magazine, which was kind of cool.
I can understand the sort of thing you're talking about, but my skills are definitely not at that hacker level.
I see that, like, so you have other, you know, capture the flag type of websites out there, you know, like hackthebox.eu, right? They put up, you know, machines that are very current, and they have like a, you know, like 100% policy, like no one is allowed to talk about it, and if you talk about it, you get permanently banned, right, before they retire a system. So, like, you don't get hints, you don't get help along the way. It's just you living off the land and doing what you can do. But when you do things like, you know, the Holiday Hack Challenge, there's, you know, an entire community, like, that, a lot of people use Discord, whatever that is, and then there's another big group of people on, you know, Central Slack or Central Sex Slack channel, and you can, you know, work with people. Hey, I'm stuck on challenge number one. I don't really know what I'm doing. You know, can anyone help out? And you get like 10 direct messages all of a sudden with people kind of telling you what to do. But Sands is also kind of included, you know, hints throughout this. Hey, this is a good article to go read, you know, or they kind of changed their focus this year from just, you know, reading articles into more of a, like, a conference format, where this year's challenge is in a 3D environment, and you make a little avatar, and you hop around Santa's castle, and up on the second floor, like, you know, you went to DerbyCon or something, you know, there would be, they're up on the second floor, they have conference rooms up there, and you, the little man jumps in the conference room, and they got a YouTube clips up on the wall that'll start playing, you know, like you're actually at the conference. And, you know, they're all pretty relevant talks. You know, some of them kind of talk about stuff that might still be part of the challenges here or not. I haven't seen it yet because I haven't finished the challenge. but yeah, it's, they try their best to try and push people towards, you know, learning something, trying to get an answer to something. And then, you know, they still have the challenges for, you know, the guys that do this stuff professionally every day. You know, the challenge I'm stuck on now, I might not finish it in time to be able to submit anything, but there's just tons of people that have already finished it already, you know, because they're definitely professionals.
Yeah, well, again, I've got a home network set up and whatnot, but I really haven't done a lot of work. For one thing, I haven't done a lot of work using the network as a network instead of just a funnel to the internet.
All right, I'll give away the answer to the first challenge here. All right, so like the very first challenge that I have for you is a, they don't call it a Raspberry Pi, they call it a Cranberry Pi, right? And they give you, you click on it, and it pops open a terminal, and here it says, you need to exit out of VI, right? So one of the hints they give you is, like, to the man page or the VI editor, right? But if you've done it before, you know, control colon, you know, pops you out of it. But if you've never done it, now you've just learned how to exit, you know, control colon, you know, pops you out of it. But if you've never done it, now you've just learned how to exit the, you know, VI. You know, it's not all about networking. It's, you know, I mean, you know, some like the PCAP files, I guess, kind of knowing, you know, your different ports and stuff like that. But, you know, a VI challenge, how to exit it, you know, that's not too bad. But if you've never seen it before, now you've learned something.
Yeah, I really haven't dug into VI or Vim like I probably should. But there's so much that I need to dig into with the Linux. I'm, you know, I'm just grinding along.
Well, I found a pretty good site for kind of getting the baseline of, you know, getting your terminal skills built up is a challenge. And all the answers are out there for it. So it's kind of easy to cheat at it. It's called Over the Wire. They have a bunch of war games on there. And the one for the, you know, for your Linux command line challenges is called Bandit. So they'll ask you to do something. And you're like, oh, well, I'm going to search directly for this. And like all the links that pop up are, you know, people's write-ups for the challenge. So it's kind of hard not to cheat yourself sometimes with it, you know. But, you know, that's a good resource for learning, you know, more about the Linux command line. You know, like I go to these conferences and I see people up there using like PMUX, in their terminal and just flying through it. And, you know, I have to have my cheat sheet out in front of me because I can't remember how to get back to the other, you know, terminal. And there's even ones out there, like Under the Wire. They do, they're all about learning, your PowerShell commands, you know, like how, you know, how, like, if you wanted to read a file in the Linux command line, you can just use cat, right? Well, Windows can kind of do the same thing, but what is that command? You know, they kind of push you down the path of learning what that command, you know, that counterpart command is.
You are aware that there is a PowerShell deb?
PowerShell deb? I'm not sure.
A Debian package by Microsoft for PowerShell? Of PowerShell?
Oh, okay. All right. Fair enough.
I just thought you might be the kind of guy who would download it for just yet.
Well, it probably would. You can just install it in your current system. It'd probably be faster than booting up a VM.
Also, using PowerShell, and I don't know how it's implemented, whether it's implemented as a true shell, i.e., you know.
Right.
Or whether it is implemented as a program that you have a separate interpreter for, it would be interesting to see how it mixes with, you know, Bash or your name your shell here. One of the things that I think that I need to do is set up a machine that only has shell or command line access. And then I would be motivated, if I'm going to work on that machine, to learn how to use that environment.
Yeah, that's kind of a hard way to go. You know, I kind of like living on both sides. You know, you see a, you know, piece of command line, something or other you'd like to, you know, type out, or, you know, a git or something that's super long, and instead of typing it all out, you know, if you're in a GUI, copy paste it in. It makes it a little bit easier. And,
well, I'm just saying, as a learning environment, again, maybe it's because I'm tainted with Windows through Windows 7 that, I think setting something up just to be command line would be helpful, though I may wait until Pi Day to see if a Pi 4 comes out.
I was listening to Hacker Public Radio years ago, and I think there's some people talking about Arch Linux all the time, and, you know, it got me interested in it, and I said, well, I'm going to give this a shot. So I actually tried installing or building Arch, however you want to look at it. You know, and that was kind of a good experience to kind of get a, you know, kind of a foundation of, like, what Linux really is. You know, it's, you know, this makeup of all this different stuff. And then, you know, someone pastes Linux on, you know, the name Linux onto it. But, you know, I don't know. There's a... To make it an everyday type of thing, you know, living on the edge like that was pretty rough. You know, so, you know, I don't really know where I would go, you know. Just a straight command line, or, you know, I think playing around with, you know, some of these CTFs where you can, you know, SSH into a Linux box, and that's your only interaction is that SSH. But, I mean, but you can still have the web to look things up, you know, but it still kind of forces you down that path. Because, you know, there was like a file on that remote server where you can't just browse to the directory and double-click and open it up. You're in an SSH session, so you've got to do it through the command line. You know, how can you download it off through SSH to your local machine? Or, you know, just read it right there on the screen. You know, it's giving you an opportunity to kind of learn those skills without, you know, suffering.
Well, actually, one thing that I've been looking at, but I haven't yet fully implemented, is GNOME boxes. I really would like to get into that because having something where I can run Linux and without having to deal with VirtualBox is really would really make me happy.
Well, that's the first time I heard of GNOME boxes, so I'm just kind of getting started looking at it here. It says it gives you access to virtual machines running locally or remotely. So you would still need to have a VM running on your system to use boxes? ?
Well, that's what boxes. You configure your VM in boxes like you would in VirtualBox, but it's Linux on Linux, and it's not. You don't have to use guest editions, stuff like that, and you get a lot closer coordination. Boxes, as far as I understand it, uses a lot more KVM, QMU, and more Linux native interfaces.
You know, it kind of makes me wonder, because, like, so I run VMware and VirtualBox. I have both of them installed on my machine. And, you know, the two of them, you know, they can play, you know, most of the time they can kind of play the same VMs if you want. But you do run into an issue where, you know, they just will not, and you actually have to convert your entire VM from one type of virtualization to the other. I wonder, you know, if you've got a whole network worth of VMware stuff already built and try and bring it into boxes, how much of a pain that would actually be, you know. But it's interesting. I'm going to have to play around with it.
Well, what I find is with VMware, you've got to convert your Linux machine to speak to VMware, which then speaks to Linux again. You know, the guest edition stuff. While Boxes doesn't have that limitation. I mean, with VirtualBox, pardon me. You've got already built into Boxes a lot of the stuff that you have to build into VirtualBox and your virtual machines with guest editions. Boxes sounds like great stuff, but it's under-documented.
Well, I think we missed the last update there, didn't we? That's sort of the last hour mark. Oops.
Ding. Ah. Can people hear me? Testing. That did light up. Can anyone actually hear me?
I have a serious question about Mumble. Does anyone know how to increase the font size?
I can hear other people, but can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Right, so this is working then. That's good. Also, am I clear or not? Because it's a new headset.
Very clear.
Really? I always had before that it was never clear, but this one hopefully is.
One of these days I've got to look for a good headset mic combo.
This was a cheap headset, but I guess it's good enough. So I've finally gotten this and missed most of it, but never mind. Is there any interesting chats been happening?
We've been covering a variety of topics from 3D printing through Mastodon through hacker challenges, a whole bunch of things.
Yeah, and I'm the only one here in 2019, I believe, at the moment, who's on this for not done this since last time, actually. So, yeah, it's kind of nice being on a podcast again, although wearing a headset does feel a bit odd when you haven't done it for ages. Well, I didn't actually have a headset last time because of some issues. Phone and headphones. What was that? And it's gone quiet again.
Yeah.
Why is that?
I have no idea. I just know that I was over here playing a game and we stopped playing it.
Oh, you're playing a game on your end.
Well, lots of games, but this last one that we were just playing was called Mission Red Planet.
Is that a Windows game?
No, actually, it's a board game. A indie board game.
Oh, board games, yeah. I don't really play those anymore, but I know certain people still quite like them. How many people have been on this so far, roughly?
There seems to be about 10 in the room at once.
At the most. When was that?
Seems to say steady in through the day.
Seems there's only three of us here at the moment.
Ken was here about noon central time.
Yeah, I had some of that. I had the had it going on from my phone to an old stereo by a Bluetooth adapter and the aux or whatever it's called. So it actually came out quite well on like that. And you can play music like that as well, connected to the internet. So no Gordon. Gordon hasn't been on, for example, the Scottish guy. Or Thistleweb, as I think he's called otherwise.
I think he was on, I can't remember what time.
I think I'll stay here about 3 hours now, unless it gets really boring or something, because it's a bit later here.
It's about 10:30 my time.
It's much later here.
What kind of headset are you using?
I just bought it recently, Chat Max, or whatever it was called. Supposed to be set up for Skype, apparently, going by the box, you know. Something standard, really. But you said that my voice is coming out very well. Or well enough.
Oh yeah, very well. It's coming out well.
Yeah, that's a nice change, because I've done this before, and there were headset issue or things like that, and then it doesn't come out properly, and all that. So that's a nice change.
I'm just running with the Memorex one.
Okay, I've got the box and that here. So yeah, I'm using the ChatMax HS-720. Apparently, it's just clearer. Converse clearly with superior USB digital audio and all that kind of stuff that they put on these things, don't they, to advertise it? But I guess it is clearer.
I had a headset where the microphone and the headphones actually were pretty decent, but when I would move my jaw, it would make a cracking sound, and it would be very distracting.
Yeah, I had the other headset I had before was okay, except when they get older, they start, like, the fake leather starts to come off and things like that, and not just headsets, or other things like that as well, you know what I mean?
You know what I mean? Oh, yeah. But actually, in this case, it was a fairly new headset. It was like a Logitech that was just a year or two old.
Yeah. I had a Logitech one before, but then the like fake leather started to come off it and all that, and it's not very good when that happens, really. 2019, the year of desktop Linux. No, that's probably not going to happen. 2019, the year of some sort of alternative mobile operating system that's Linux-based, taken off. That might happen, because I don't mean Ubuntu Touch or any of that stuff. That's not going anywhere like that now. But I don't mean Sellerfish from Yolo or the former Nokia people, but I did read there was another operating system called FeatureOS or something like that. It's also being sold on the new Nokia phones from the new company who own their brand. So I guess something like that could take off more as well. But yeah, to be honest, all the phones I'm kind of interested in are the kind of alternative things. The Libre M, which you probably heard of somewhere, Purism, the KDE phones are coming. They can't even go onto an actual mobile network at the moment. And so on. Did anyone actually hear that?
I heard it, but you're kind of fading in and out a little bit.
I faded in and out. Oh, right. Maybe. But I was saying that, yeah, these alternative... Well, some of the alternative things that are coming are interesting, like the KDE phones that can't go onto a mobile network and the Purism, Librem, and all this kind of stuff.
Only the Purism one was the one that was pretty well advertised. I haven't heard anything about the KDE one.
There's kind of two KDE phones ready that are the actual... can't remember quite now without looking properly, but basically there's the, I think it's the Slim, no, the actual KDE phone, and then they can't go onto the mobile network. It's like a Wi-Fi only thing to begin with. And then there's another company, a Finnish company, also going to do one. But again, you can't go onto the mobile network on these first versions. But they're bringing KDE to phones basically. So that's interesting as well. And it said, why don't you do Purism? And they were like, no, they've gone with GNOME. So, we're doing our separate things.
I've got to figure out how to use a Wi-Fi only phone.
Well, that's the point. I think it's because the actual mobile networks to connect, you have to use proprietary software of some sort. And these phones are completely free software. So you can't connect everything that's to do with it. And it's also as a kind of a first device to show that it can be done. So it's Wi-Fi only. And I think they even said the phone to them isn't necessarily going to a network and using it like that. It's to like have a device that's mobile. But yeah, I mean, the networks are proprietary. It's some sort of proprietary bit. It may make sense because otherwise you could just come out and make your own phone pretty much and connect to a mobile network and then use it for free as well, which is not going to like actual mobile networks.
Yeah, well, if I was going to go serious with Wi-Fi, I would have to go get myself some private internet access.
What, like a VPN, you mean?
Yes, that's actually the name of a private internet of a VPN company.
Isn't that the one that sponsors Freenode as well, isn't it? I think.
I don't know, but it seems to be a good deal, and it wouldn't take me too much to convert my network over to it.
Well, yeah, but I did mean like mobile phones, but they're not. They just can't be used for actual text or calls at the moment, or to begin with, because of how it's done. But it's all kind of interesting stuff that's on the verge of coming.
Well, they can't be used on the wide network. You probably could use them on Vonage or something like that.
Say that again? Did you say Lineage?
Vonage.
What's Lineage?
IP phone.
Oh, right. Also, I see 5150 appeared in here again.
Howdy, folks.
Hello. I've not spoken to you for about a year, but hello.
Yeah, how's everything going?
Yeah, so it's okay, you?
Can't complain, didn't get back in as early as I thought I would tonight, but...
No, I've had exactly that as well. I mean, I haven't got on here at all until about half an hour ago, and it's already quite late here, really, but that's fine. Just...
More people in the room than there were earlier this morning.
Say that again?
I said there's a lot more people in the room than there were earlier this morning.
Yeah, I guess. I
didn't check my start time, or I would have been out here earlier.
Start time for what? To get back or to get on this?
To get on this, I was reading it backwards.
What do you mean, reading it backwards?
If I was thinking that it was going to start evening my time instead of morning my time. I'm in the Eastern Standard Time Zone.
Yeah, well, no, that's fine. It's 26 hours. It's basically going to be drop in when people drop in, and then... No, well, some people stay for most of it, depending on the year, but that's fine. Actually, you stayed for most of it the other about 2 years ago, didn't you, 5150?
I don't know if that was 2 or 3 years ago, but yeah, I was, except for when I had to go do chores, I was on nearly the whole 26 hours, and I wasn't, Ken can tell you, I wasn't making any kind of good sense by the end.
No, and I kept it going nicely in the after show a few years ago as well, or 3 years ago or something.
Well, good evening, folks. My name here is Steve.
Welcome, Steve.
From America, I assume.
Yes, and I think pretty close to 5150, if I'm not mistaken. I'm in Kansas in the United States.
Yeah, you're actually his neighbor. Very close.
Fancy that, another Linux user in Kansas.
He's actually your neighbor, very close.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember, I actually met you, 5150, briefly at the Kansas Linux Fest a couple years ago in Wichita.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, you know, sometimes I get trouble keeping people I've met that often very straight, but yeah, good. I've been trying. There's another person who wanted to take the lead on it, but had an idea of maybe doing something next spring. I think we're running into, you know, getting too late, maybe for all next year, doing another fest, but it's not completely, you know, cold and dead or whatever. There's a few of us that would still like to see something done.
Yeah, for sure. I'd like to see something done too. I know some of the guys that were in charge of it those 2 years that it was at WSU, and I can understand that they don't want to do it every year, but I'm hoping that somebody does pick it up and run with it at some point.
Well, are you talking about conferences?
Yeah, the Kansas Linux Fest. It's happened 3-4 years maybe total, and not a huge turnout, but the last year it did not happen, and we're just talking we'd like to see somebody pick it up and run with it again.
Yeah, too far for me. I can't go to that one. Way too far away. But it's probably a good conference otherwise.
Well, that last year we had Mad Dog there, so I think it was very successful. It's just, like Steve said, I think those guys doing it 2 years in a row, they just had some amount of burnout. And I was and anybody in Kansas is interested, if we'd all get together somehow and, you know, form a core group where it's not on any, you know, 4 or 5 people every year or something, you know, I would certainly be interested in participating. I'm a little far from any major city to, you think you can get everything done online, but it's a lot easier if you're there where the event is going to be held. But, you know, definitely I want to be a part of it when we do it again.
Yes, we had a dog. Well, Joe had a dog.
Yes, I do. I have a couple of them. And in-laws.
Oh, we've pretty much got the entire Linux Lugcast on the line right now.
Yeah, I'm not sure if Honky's really there. I've talked to him a couple of times, but he hasn't really responded.
Yep. He was on this morning, but you're right. I think he's on just more to record and maintain stuff and all that.
So my project lately has been trying to set up a FreeNAS server. Anybody mess with FreeNAS before?
No.
Not in a really long time.
Yeah, I've got an actual file server on a Pi that I use, but I've wanted to look into it, but these days I'd go with NAS for free just because you don't have the huge memory requirement.
Yeah, I haven't really looked at that one. I have to say FreeNAS is pretty cool. I mean, yeah, you're right. It does have a fairly large memory requirement to do it right, but the interface and the operations and the ease of use is pretty slick. They've done a pretty good job.
So what interfaces and distros are being used there at the moment?
You asking about FreeNAS or just in general?
No, I mean, I'm a different topic. I mean, like Linux distros and interfaces.
Gotcha. Well, I'm a longtime Slackware user, and on servers, I run about 80 Slackware servers. But for desktops, I've kind of gravitated toward the Zubuntu, which is Ubuntu with the XFCE desktop. That's my personal favorites.
Yeah, why for Xubuntu or XFCE?
Well, I first got introduced to XFCE on Slackware, actually, because I was running Slackware on a desktop, and that's what it comes with. Well, it comes with KDE, but it also comes with XFCE, and I just really learned to like it. I don't know exactly why, but I did, and so when I switched over to the Ubuntu line, I just stuck with it, and it does what I want, and I'm kind of a minimalist user in a way, or utility user, not terribly much into the flashy stuff, so that's why I choose it.
Yeah, so, I mean, a lot of people go, oh yeah, you should use XFCE, and I've never really, every time I've tried it out since 2004, it's never quite cut it. But then you're getting get used to GNOME 2, because it's like, Fedora had GNOME 2, and Ubuntu had GNOME 2 as default, and obviously Mate more recently and all that. And then you've got GNOME 3, which I did like, GNOME Shell. But you can probably guess from the name I've decided to put on, temporarily at least, what I'm running at the moment. Because it says Unity 7 in that. But I personally think that, yeah, if you're going to run Ubuntu, even though this got dropped and the whole, well, the phone stuff's gone to community now, on top of that, Unity 8. But I just felt like when that came out, I mean, they got a lot of flack for it and everything, but they were actually trying to do some innovation here, and the consumer innovation, trying to get, like, usual people to use it, and I think they were on something there. It was better than the old GNOME 2 patching they used to do. And now I feel like if you're going to run GNOME Shell, you might as well just do it in some other distro, because, you know, there's plenty of other distros that run GNOME Shell, and you could debate better, even. So I don't... So, yeah, I'm kind of living in the past if I'm running Unity 7, because it's been dropped, but I am currently, because a bit like you, it does actually work. It's quite easy to use. You've got your icons there. It's, you know, it's quite easy to actually get things done whilst you're running it. Whereas something like GNOME 3, GNOME Shell is nice and good, but it's also more flashy, which can get a bit annoying sometimes, depending on what you're doing.
Yeah, I never actually ran Unity. I thought I should probably try it sometime and just see what it's like, but so I really don't have any opinion on it, but I was used to the XFCE, so I gravitated towards that, and I'm not the type of guy that goes looking for a lot of changes. If I can get it to do what I want it to do, then I'm usually happy, so that's how I kind of roll.
Yeah, that's what I'm like as well, generally speaking. Yeah, one good false ass up. Oh, and of course the other thing with Unity was that it was tied to Ubuntu because of how it was made, basically. They tried to port it to Fedora and OpenSUSE, but there was some technical issues. And then the Unity 8 interface was never good enough on the desktop quite. It was getting there. It was progress, but then it got dropped. On the phone and tablets, now under UB ports though, what's left of that in the community. I mean, that's very good. That works really well, I'd say. And I've got some of those devices myself. Well, I've got a broken tablet because of some issue being dropped, and then someone's going to fix it, and it came back in an even worse state, and I've got two of the phones. And the other one is KDE. I've got involved with a distro that a lot of people use KDE by default as well, but I never really liked KDE. It was always very bloated. It looks like Windows as well, but, well, you can go beyond that. And really, Microsoft did copy certain features off KDE. There's an old video, someone on YouTube, I assume still, Australian Mole with, this is Windows 7, they say to people, it's actually KDE 4. But yeah, it's great. We have all this choice of interfaces and even file managers and terminals and all kinds of things.
Yeah, kind of like you. I tried KDE long, long time ago, and I wasn't overly impressed then, but my understanding is it's changed a huge amount and is a lot better than it was, and so I think it's a viable option, but I've just not messed with it in the last decade, I guess.
It's changed. KDE3 was this. It lives on under the Trinity project, actually, which is good. KDE4 is quite different in certain ways, and then this KDE5, or it's just called Plasma now, is again different, but it doesn't quite cut it for me. There's just something, I don't know, it just doesn't do it for me. A bit like XFCE, which you obviously like, but again, it doesn't quite cut it for me. I tried LXD and stuff like that before, it doesn't quite do it. But I guess it's kind of what you're used to and how when you got introduced to something and what you kind of went along with, and then you sort of get your own personal preferences, and that applies to everyone. We like different things for different reasons.
Well, that's the great thing about Linux is it's, you know, far more customization than is to your personal taste that is possible.
Yeah, that's
the proprietary.
Yeah, that's basically what I was saying earlier. We have more customization choices and choices of interfaces, distros, and all kinds of things, whereas you won't really have that with Windows or as much, and Mac and things like that.
My preference is a lighter hierarchical interface rather than, say, Unity or GNOME 3, where they put your five most used applications at the top. I prefer to have stuff, you know, broken up, Office, Internet, games, whatever, you know, on a main menu. And like I said, lights, things like Mate, LXQT, XFCE, something like that.
Yeah, you mean like categories, groups, because there was an extension. No, I think GNOME 2 used to do that, or usually. You'd have like your internet group, your office group, and graphics and games and all this. And I think that with the other ones, you can get extensions that would allow for that. But I think even GNOME 3 did it for a while, but then that got dropped, so I'm not sure quite. But I think I get what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, I've run GNOME 3, and
what was that? Says GNOME 3, what did you say?
Well, like I walked on Joe, but yeah, I ran GNOME 3 to try it out, and I did put in those aforementioned extensions, but it's like, you know, might as well start out with a lighter desktop that it's already organized like that.
You can say something, Joe?
Oh, no, I don't have something on this conversation. I was going to ask Paul if he's still at the house, but he doesn't seem to be responding.
Did you get any interesting devices? I'm gonna say last year now, referring to 2018. I think you're about to be in 2019. But anyway, you know what I mean. So let's say 2018. Did you get any new interesting Linux-based devices or anything like this? 5150. Because I remember we had this chat before, and you were like, "Yeah, got the GPD, got the next dock it was back then, and so on."
Yeah, well, there is. I don't have a GPD yet, but there is one, I guess, coming out in February. That's going, you know, of course, have less features, less power, but it's going to be $300.
I do have GPD devices. So I've got the GPD XD with one of the few people who actually have it with more space, so than 128 GB instead of the 64, because they did like a crowdfund again for that. I read that that's coming out with like a GPD XD Pro with a few changes soon as well, which is probably no point in me actually getting, but people who don't have it. That's a like Android one with their customized interface and for gaming. Then I've got a GPD Win, which I've had Linux on there, basically. I've got a GPD Pocket, that's very nice.
Yeah, I'm interested in the Pocket too.
There's a GPD Pocket 2 as well, which is slightly updated to the GPD Pocket. Slightly different hardware specs.
No, I'm interested in the Pocket 2, and because, you know, it's got like twice the processor of the original Pocket, and they changed the layout of the keys, and they changed the style of the mouse, which I understand was an issue on the first one. But I'm definitely not interested in the price tag on either one.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's the one other thing with these devices is that I'm from the UK, so I'm going to say that these devices are selling over £300, which, you know, you could buy a laptop for that kind of money, or a reasonably cheap laptop, but...
Right.
You know,
you could get the Microsoft Surface Go for that price and put Linux on it. But, yeah, between $500 and $700... US, and that's a little rough for a 7-inch device. Yeah, it's got good stats, but still.
Well, yeah, same with, say, the Libra Purism, Libra M5, which we were talking about earlier. That's coming out, but it's going to be sold for about £500, which is, yeah, again, it's like a new laptop with that kind of money, and that would be a reasonably good spec laptop as well.
Right, so, and by the time it comes out, it's going to have an older processor in it, and it's not going to be, you know, top of the line, which is what they, the problem that they had last time. Well,
which one?
Oh, which one was it that came out as that was listed as an open source Linux phone?
Oh, the well, that was the Ubuntu phones, and there was a Sailfish device.
The one that was crowdfunded as well. Purism.
Yeah. Pure, that one. Okay, Purism. That's what I was talking about. But yeah, somebody said that from my Linux user group. He just said, oh, that's a rubbish phone because the specs aren't that good, and then it's going to come out and it'll be even older, and maybe the hardware specs won't be that great. But the thing is, with that one, I mean, they've released these laptops already. It's all about the, like, privacy and security as well. Like, you've got the hardware kill switches for your webcam and all this kind of stuff built in. That's kind of what's meant to sell it as well.
Well, if it's got that, if it's got a good enough interface that you can hook it up to a mouse and a keyboard and a screen and have it actually be a Linux system, then I might still look at it for my next phone, or I might wait until it's a used device and get it then. Yes. But, yeah.
Well, it's going to have an interface. So by default, it's getting GNOME 3, but GNOME Shell with a few changes to make it go on the phone hardware. So that's what's coming. And then KDE are doing these separate phones as well. Two companies are going to do them, but without Wi-Fi to be, so without mobile networks to begin with, only Wi-Fi for those to begin with.
Yep.
But yeah, Libra M, it's interesting, but it's very pricey for what it is. That's the one thing.
Yeah, I would love to have one, but if I could really, really justify it for work, 10 years ago, 15, before I really got into Linux, I had a Sony Palm Top, which was the, you know, kind of looked like a four-factor of a camera, and you had like a 3 or 4 inch LCD that you would push up, and then it would have a keyboard under where the LCD originally was and all that. And that was that if I was, you know, working in a school and went into a lab or something, I didn't have to say, hey kid, I need to use the computer, get off. Not that I would have done something, but occasionally, yeah, you'd go in a room and, to fix something, and you know, every workstation would be occupied, and you'd have to reschedule or whatever, you know, go do something else. So that was nice that I could just get on the network and do my work any place. And I think that thing was like $1,400 or some ridiculous amount when I bought it, and I just time, yeah, that's, you know, it's something I'm gonna use all the time in work. But, you know, the GPD, you know, I want something with the form factor of the GPD that I can just put in a pocket on a pair of cargo pants and just carry it around everywhere. But, you know, even the $500, $600 ones, for a toy to get out and say, hey, look, isn't this pretty? That's too much. And I'm thinking eventually it's got to come down.
Right.
Go ahead. Right. So yeah, the GPD pocket has a nice keyboard. It's quite small. It's 7-inch device. There's in the GPD pocket too. And I can't remember unless I look for it now because my mind's gone blank. But basically the PDA came back as well recently. And I saw one of these, and it's like, okay, cool. And it's because it has, you could run a Sailfish on it, you can run Android on it, and you can run, I believe, some sort of Linux on it, an actual Linux distro. And it did, yeah, GMINI PDA or something like that was called. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that'll be it. And that's
can
like
you,
even
can
smaller.
Can you post that in the chat?
I'll have to look for a link, but GM9 okay. and EPDA or something like that. Yeah, I'll look for a link. I saw one of these, and that's like even smaller than the GPD Win stuff and all that. But
I know the one you're talking about. Okay, yeah, the Gemini.
Yeah, that'll be it, won't it? Gemini. Yeah, Gemini PDA. That sounds right. And it was that was a nice little device as well. I got to see one as a demo device, and yeah.
Well, I saw one advertised the other day. The thing is, it's one of these ads, and this is something Facebook ought to pay for more even than the privacy, is selling ad space to people who just take the whole ad from somebody else, cut and paste, and then I looked online on Google because I knew the price was way too good to be true. The price was like $60 for this thing. You know, if I get it for $60, I'd buy five. But looked it up. Yeah, the price was, I think, over $600 easy. So put that up to one of the completely scam ads that are going around Facebook, just trying to get your credit card number.
Facebook advertising. I guess we all probably respond to some of those adverts here and there, but there was something that popped up yesterday morning or night that got me onto something that was like an online seminar about something, and that was kind of interesting. And also, I've been doing small events, here, so European idea really, called Linux Presentation Day. And the idea is you want to do these events twice a year and get the general public in to show them Linux and get them using Linux. Nice idea, except actually getting sort of usual enough people in is very difficult. But I had a go at Facebook advertising for the last all of those, and it failed one of those times. Like, no one came in from it, but it did bring in a few people. But the only downfall is it comes out to like 4,000-5,000 people from sort of your area and further away, but it doesn't quite bring enough people in for the money, or it needs to be set up to target. And my headset's gone weird, I think.
No, it's Vinit.
It's Vinit.
Yeah, Vinit, you need to switch to push to talk, Vinit.
Well, I wasn't push to talk.
Hey, everyone, this is Claudio M. Just wishing you a very happy new year. It just struck 12 over here in Miami. Happy new year, everybody.
Happy new year.
Happy new year, sir.
Happy new year, except it's 5 a.m. just after, actually.
Happy new year.
Happy new year, East
Coast.
It's
still like 10 o'clock here.
Yes, well, it's 12:04 right now, so we just got done talking with family members and everything, so I figured I'd jump in and wish everybody a happy new year here from Miami, Florida. Anyway, wishing everybody else a happy new year once you get there. See you in 2019. Good night, guys. Catch you in the morning.
All right, night, yeah. Happy new year. I guess my headset's okay now. I don't know what happened there then.
No, it wasn't you.
It wasn't actually me. Okay.
It was Venant, I guess, not using a headset. You're too close to the mic or something. But it seems to be corrected now.
So I was saying that PDA device was nice, and then and then it's like, oh, so that's another device that can run Sailfish on it. Oh, that could be interesting. But it's another £500 device or something. But that's the one downfall with its interest,
right.
Isn't
it's
it?
Still...
The one downfall with this kind of interest
is it's a $600 device with less of a processor than the GPDs, and yeah, it's a slightly nicer, smaller form factor. But I think I'd still rather, if I were going to spend that kind of money, go with the GPD.
GPD Pocket and Pocket 2 is a bit bigger, but yeah. that's good anyway. It's good. It's quite small, and plus you can plug in a normal USB keyboard and mouse if you want to do that. You know, it's like, not sure you can do that with the other one.
The Gemini, it has two USB C slots, so you should be able to get an adapter and then hook up a USB keyboard.
I like how you say adapter now, because yeah, this USB C stuff. I mean, you know, the only devices I have that require USB C are quite simply the GPD Pocket and the, I think the GPT Win as well, and maybe the XD, right? And everything else is USB, you know, 2 or whatever, the standard, you know, the old stuff. And it's just really annoying because I was doing this event and it's like, oh, I need to get that charged up. Where's my cable gone for charging? I'm going to have to buy a new cable. Right. And I was buying it there and now from a shop, so it cost a bit.
And not only that, but if nobody has a USB-C charger, then you need the specific USB-B to USB-C.
I don't know about the charger quite. It seems to go in a normal charger. You just change the cable.
Right.
Well, the one saving factor of the Gemini is it can be used as a phone, but I don't, you know, I have no interest in a $600 phone either.
No, although on the subject of USB-C, why have they done that? What was wrong with the old, you know, the old standard one that most of these devices have? Why have they updated it?
I think it was to save space, because this Gemini is a very thin-looking device.
You know, USB-C is smaller, you're saying, where the cable goes in?
Yes.
So other than that, there's not much difference between the two, really.
Well, USB-C can do video, it can... It's all singing, all dancing.
Well, there are different types of USB-C, so depending on the type that it is, it's between, like, 5 Mbps all the way up to, like, 40 Mbps?
Yes, hang on a minute. Yes, Urilu, whatever you're called. There's a Freenode HPR, Oddcast Planet. I assume you heard that.
Yeah, thank you. I was gonna give him that exact same message.
And you've done it in text now. That should work. Yeah. But yeah, this USB-C. I mean, it just feels like they've kind of updated for the sake of updating, generally speaking. But maybe you can do video and sound like somebody just said. But you know what I mean.
Yeah, as I understand it, USB-C can do a whole lot more, and the whole idea is to integrate video networking. Serial everything onto one bus type thing. I don't know a lot of the details, but it's got some pretty cool features. The question is how well is it utilized and how well are all of those features supported on all the devices? And I think we got a ways to go for that to happen.
Well, it says it's going to be like the BIOS in the old PC, apparently, which is a bit of a different subject, kind of, but like, there was no standard, they said, and then they came out with all this UI nonsense, which, had some right issues with this laptop about a year ago, but I found the ideal kernel parameter workaround to get things working. Like a standard, like if there's no standard, all the devices, things aren't going to be supported exactly the same, that's what I meant.
UEFI, when it came out, kind of felt like a direct attack on open source operating systems.
Well, apparently when there's no keys, yeah. Or at first, or yeah.
Yeah, at first, you know, you couldn't get keys for Linux to be able to get it to run.
But I thought everybody got keys relatively quickly. I thought like Ubuntu and Red Hat bought keys or got keys right off the bat and everybody just used those. It was a lot of like... When it was more speculative, the UEFI stuff was more speculative. I thought it was right. More of like the great fear of they're trying to, you know, keep us out.
Yeah, that's what it felt like. Didn't end up that way, but.
Well, and then there was the, you know, I think early last year, the, I don't know if it was Microsoft or Intel made the change. You know, somebody had said that, no, we're not going to install our software. I think it's actually Microsoft said that you know, you can't, if you make your computer so that you have to have a UEFI key, then, you know, we won't sell you Windows or something. I don't know if that was them or maybe it was Intel. And I think that was rescinded. So there is the possibility now of a machine being built that, you know, only runs the operating system that it came with.
Yeah, I think Microsoft wanted to do that with some of their laptops or tablets as well or originally, and then that kind of changed a bit.
Yeah, that just came out just a couple months ago. I think I heard that, but I don't really know what the status of it is now.
Thing with UEFI, I mean, yeah, okay, school boot, disable it, Linux distro booting, all this. But here's a story, a very true story. That was very frustrating. I'll say it reasonably quickly, I suppose, but, so, yeah, I had my laptop here, which I'm on at the moment, and the motherboard failed. I mean, this HP laptop had problems from day one. It would overheat. There would be an error in Windows, things overheating. I rang them up, waste of time. And then it lasted about a year or nearly 2 years. And then motherboard failed. Had somebody look at it, couldn't fix it. Somebody else couldn't really do it. So I got it sent off to their partner company to get the motherboard replaced. And I had to pay like £213 to do that, which was annoying. Somebody said, due to consumer rights law, your laptop's worth £500. It should have worked 5 years, but I didn't play it. Do push for that enough or whatever, so I had to pay. And it came back, and of course Windows loads up and all that, so they think it's fixed. And so here I am, 2017, at say what we call Boxing Day here. I don't know if you do that in America, the day after Christmas.
No, we don't like, do it. But...
Yeah, the day after Christmas Day we call Boxing Day in the UK. So 26th of December. And I'm like thinking, right, I've done all the Windows updating, I've updated Windows, I've done all the reboots of my upgrading back to Windows 10, all this, you know. I'm on the Linux stage, woohoo! And so I got my USB stick for Ubuntu or something, and I put it into the machine, and it doesn't load up at first, or it loads up, but then it black screens when I load up a Linux kernel, try to load up the live session, try a different USB stick, same problem, try a few, all this black screening, I make a look at the UEFI BIOS, and I basically can't boot my Linux distros up, and so, in the meantime, I had to use Windows, because I mean, Windows worked, so, you know, and I went to my Linux user group, can somebody look at this, can you, you know, no one could really do anything as such. And then eventually this guy was like, how about trying ACPI equals off as a kernel parameter? And that loaded it up, but then the Wi-Fi, it turns out, isn't working and it can't suspend and things like this. And he says, probably a problem with the Wi-Fi not having a driver. I tried a driver. No, it should be on there. And I looked around Google myself, a few weeks later, and I found another kernel parameter, like on the Ubuntu form. Somebody was like, I had this problem. I got a black screen and it basically said ACPI underscore OSI equals. And I put that in there with my kernel parameter in the grub. And then it was like magic. It's like magic. It loads up. The Wi-Fi works. The SPEM works. All of this. But it's kind of interesting because you've got to be like sort of honest with the computer or honest enough. Because if you have nothing, it means nothing. There's an operating system on here. I can't tell you what it is. So load it up. We can maybe try with Windows or Linux on the end of that and it might work or might not work. But I was talking about how that's like being honest with a computer at the same time. So that was interesting. But yeah, all this because of some silly UEFI and my motherboard being replaced. It's going to be the same motherboard, but I guess updated it slightly. We'd updated the BIOS, same problem. I had a BIOS bug or something in the UEFI, and I still do, really, but I have a workaround for it. So yeah, my Linux is working.
Right, right. No, I had the ACPI off issue until very recently, and it had to do with Ubuntu kernel updates that made my particular motherboard go from working perfectly with suspend and resume, and I could monitor the battery and all of that. It just wouldn't load, and I had to use ACPI equals off, and all of that functionality went away. And then, like, with the most recent kernel update, I've been able to remove that from my grub parameters, and everything started working again. So every now and then, you might want to go in and manually delete the ACPI parameters there and load up and see if it works. And then if it doesn't, just load up again. And, you know, don't permanently change it until the fix is actually in.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, my ACPI equals off was, like, what this guy found from my Linux user group. And that, so I like I said, I tried that, but then my wireless wouldn't work and my suspend's not working and things like this. But with the other kernel parameter that came up, it was like the magic workaround. It really was. Like ACPI underscore OSI operating system information equals, I assume that stands for. And then I put that in. I don't tell it what operating system's on. I just put that in and it all works. The Wi-Fi works. It's like magic. But it's still some sort of workaround for some sort of problem that is still on, that I still have really. But at least I got Wi-Fi working and suspend, and I'm still actually typing in to grab myself because I just can't be bothered to go and edit the config file, but I can actually edit the config file if I want to.
Just every now and again, start it up without it and see if it works.
But maybe a new kernel or something would fix it, yeah.
Right.
But eventually. if it's a problem with the actual BIOS, the firmware, then I guess that's it, really, isn't it? If there's a bug, they're not going to fix it, are they, or anytime soon?
Unless there's a BIOS update for it.
We updated the BIOS, and I still had the same problems, so to the latest BIOS. And actually, my other issue as well was because I'd put Windows 10 on, or updated the 8.1 back to Windows 10, I couldn't actually downgrade back far enough to the original, say, 2015 BIOS, because that would only go back so far on Windows 10 and third on 8.1. But that might have helped if I could have downgraded far enough with the BIOS. But I couldn't do that, so yeah.
What's going on, Joe?
Not much. Just, you know, hanging out with the in-laws.
I have a couple of UEFI machines. Is there any which I run? I don't know. As I don't knowingly run them in UEFI mode. Is there? Where is the benefit for UEFI?
That's exactly it. There basically is no benefit as a Linux user. Because, like, for example, let's just take the classic, to put your USB stick up. I believe you can do it possibly without doing this now, but you'd have to disable secure boot. So you're basically disabling one of the main features of UEFI, which is meant to stop the USB sticks loading up because of security anyway. And I think there generally is no benefit as a Linux user with UEFI, quite simply, unless somebody knows otherwise, but it mostly just causes problems for people who are running Linux, or can do.
Well, also, I think there may be more benefit if you're running
Windows, yeah, Windows.
No, if you're running very, very large disk.
What, such as what?
Several terabytes per device.
Why would UEFI give you a benefit?
Well, it allows you to slice the disk without going to extended partitioning.
I'm not sure about that, but possibly, yeah.
No, you're talking. Okay, now that did come out at roughly the same time as UEFI, where the BIOS is allowed for larger disks to be used as boot disks, but it was really two separate things that were going on at the same time.
Okay, so it's the GPT partition table that I'm actually thinking of.
No, the GPT partitions, right? Yeah, that's to do with UEFI as well because of how it's like set up. So you need like a GPT partition table. That's right, and then you have to sort of tell it to the distro to like use the UEFI partition to boot and things like that normally as well.
Okay, it's the GPT partition table that allows you to slice your four terabyte disk into, you know, DVD sized chunks if you want.
Like, yeah, possibly. I don't know about that. And then I was going to quickly say, and then also with UEFI, because of how it's done again, you basically have a different version of grub. And then you have a from the old version that will be for the BIOS. I know that from Linux distros.
Found an interesting thing from Oracle of all places. Notes on the Sunblade X32B administration guide. UEFI allows you to boot hard drive partitions larger than 2 terabytes. Support for more than 4 partitions on a drive. Fast booting. Supposedly efficient power and system management, and better reliability and fault management.
Right, so maybe useful for servers or something like that, but for average people and Linux users or whatever, probably not so much.
Yeah, I don't have a 2 terabyte boot partition.
No, I think most people don't somehow.
I don't know, storage is getting pretty cheap.
So, SSD storage as well.
Odd side note, what is Boxing Day?
Say that again? Boxing Day.
What is it? Yeah.
I said that earlier. Yeah. Did you miss that, or did you hear me?
About what Boxing Day is? I heard that you celebrate it. I didn't hear what it was.
Well, it's... celebrate, well... not exactly. I mean, well, kind of, I guess. It's basically, you have like the Boxing Day sales as well. Like Christmas Day has been, so now they want to sell out. They want to sell stuff again in a sale, old Christmas stock possibly. But it is a bank holiday, so yeah, people get that day off work as well.
Actually, since I looked this up, just last week, Boxing Day was the holiday for those people in service or service industries who worked on Christmas.
It might have been in the past, but now it's like it's basically a day off for everybody. It's bank holiday, and it's about selling some of the old Christmas stock possibly as well, although a lot of certain shops will still be closed.
Well, it basically gives the Commonwealth people who celebrate it another Black Friday.
Yeah, well, kind of, yeah. And then also, well, like, when you have, like, the Boxing Day walk when I grew up and stuff, as a kid, you know, like, that. I think that's a possible tradition. You would go off for, like, a walk on Boxing Day with a group of people or something, or at least we've done that. I say possibly, so it varies a bit.
Well, I can see that being useful. People who have been home with their families over the Christmas Day holiday can get together with their friends and not intrude on the family celebration.
Yeah, something like that, I guess. I mean, it's not really celebrated properly, but it is like a day off, so yeah, people get that off work and stuff. And to be honest, there are very few bank holidays in England, as they called it, like days off like that. And I was reading that somewhere the other day. It's like Christmas Day, yeah. That everyone gets that off, sure, pretty much. Boxing Day, and I think Easter, and that's about it, really. And one or two others, and two in August as well. And then normally on a Monday
Disney's
as well.
Disney's live YouTube's going off.
What is it?
Oh, maybe the pre-show.
And basically, people get New Year's Day off as well, most people.
Basically, it sounds like Boxing Day is a little bit the same concept as Labor Day in the U.S.,
possibly. I don't really know much about Labor Day, but yeah, possibly.
Well, I mean, Labor Day is in September, but it's a day off for businesses and that kind of thing. It's not celebrating some event or whatever, and that's what it sounds like Boxing Day sort of is.
Also, there's no, well, like, oh, I'm vegetarian anyway, but that's not the point. There's no, like, in America, you have, you know, Thanksgiving, the turkey, and all this, right? But in England and the UK, there is no Thanksgiving. We don't have Thanksgiving, but we do have turkey at Christmas and the stuffing and things like that. And also, you got your 4th of July, which was to, I'm half Swedish anyway, so whatever, I can say this, and to get free from the British, 4th of July. We don't have that, obviously, but we have our bonfire night, the celebration, which is the 5th of November. That's a good one, actually. Fireworks and, well, an excuse for fireworks. So, yeah.
Well, don't you have a Guy Fawkes Day?
Guy Fawkes Day, yeah. Is that what you meant?
Pardon my pronunciation, I'm speaking American.
Yeah. Guy Fawkes, that's what I'm talking about. That's bonfire night, but the 5th of November, Guy Fawkes, yeah.
What is that supposed to celebrate? Sorry.
Reforming Parliament with a barge load of gunpowder.
There you go.
It didn't come off, but the British are celebrating somebody who gave it a darn good try.
Well, it is what it is, and it's, I mean, it's happened in, I think, 1600 something, without even looking up on Google or whatever, you know, like 4 centuries ago, but it's basically been an excuse to have a bonfire ever since. And then more recently, fireworks and sparklers and for the kids and things like this as well.
Well, actually, just like San Francisco is waiting for the quake. England is waiting for the mouth of the Thames to erupt. It will make Guy Fawkes very happy. There is a shipload of World War II ordnance marking the mouth of the Thames.
So they've just been steering around it all this time?
Yes, because nobody wants to bell that cat. Now, also, during the war, they stored a bunch of ordnance in some slate mines. Some bright chap had problems removing a fuse from one of the bombs, so he decided to tap on it with a brass drift. There was an eruption which was the largest non-nuclear explosion in the United Kingdom.
On the subject of London, something that really does annoy me usually, I just watched a film called Mortal Engines, actually, that was in the cinema, which was a failed blockbuster. They're going to lose money on this film, a lot of money, but I thought it was based on a book. It was quite a good film, I thought, for what it was. But, okay, fine, it was actually London, the city that's moving around in this film. But does this... But, like, you watch a film or a TV show and you've got, like, the British and they basically have this sort of, like posh London accent or it's always the same, like, stereotypes. And it could be the let's have a cup of tea thing and it's just really annoying sometimes because, you know, a lot of people don't sound like that, actually, who are from the UK. And it's just annoying. It's a lot of stereotypes and stuff.
Yes, well, I live in New England, and between Boston, and the people in Maine, where I have roots, you know, there's a lot of stereotypical stuff up here.
Well, I'm from Texas, and I like beef, and I like Tex-Mex.
Yeah, and
you are the stereotype.
Wait, New England, is a lot of people from England came there? Is that why it's called New England?
Yes. That's why I live, why we have Boston from Bolivston in England, and, well, there's a Cambridge over here, and
that. Yeah, I know that. Some of the names are both in the UK and in America. And then we've got the Texas Cowboy, yeah?
And they like building tunnels in both places.
We don't particularly like it. It's just the only way to get around if you're not going to lift the city up. If you've got to put a road network or a subway network, you have to tunnel.
Come on,
there you go. Both places tunnels are required. How about that?
I was gonna say something like tunnels or Mexico, but then I thought that's the wrong state, isn't it?
Everybody liked the big dig.
I guess Elon's gonna come along and fix all the cities for us.
I don't know how's that gonna affect all the fracking.
Actually, there was some grandiose plans to give London a series of ring roads, which I believe the M25 is the only survivor.
The M25. That's an absolutely amazing, awesome road in when it's very, very busy. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, totally.
For those in the Northeast, the M25 is basically 128 with half the lanes.
The M25 is just an awful motorway when it's busy. That's about all you can say about it. But I don't live near there, so I don't need to go on that road usually.
What I'm fascinated by is first the fact that they're building new canals and. We talk about terrible public transportation, but the good doctor in the 60s did his best to decapitate the British rail network, and he did a fairly good job.
The thing with the railway network in England and, well, I suppose the whole of the UK, really, or the main bits, Wales, England and Scotland, I guess, as well, but definitely England, there's a few things here. One, the trains are known to be delayed or late compared to, say, the mainland of Europe, where they're known to be on time a lot. That's one point. Two, the prices are going up like crazy each year. Like, they just upped the prices twice last year, or three times, maybe four times, and people are not happy because the service on these trains is not that great. Even in first class, it's not particularly you know, it's not that great. And then the railway lines themselves aren't maintained that well. And when I'm saying that, a lot of lines are actually closed and from the past and still are when it could be open. And it's just not particularly good. Well, for what you actually get for your money. And then they say, oh, but we're going to change the lines and we need to get money for that. And that. But luckily, again, I don't have to go on a train to work every morning, whereas a lot of people do. So I don't have that problem. I go on a train about once a year and that's it for a Linux event, probably.
Well, I've studied the British Rails and it was an interesting situation. They privatized the thing, yet the privatized rail system is still heavily subsidized.
Oh yes, I mean, it's supposed to go under government control, but it's not quite happened. There's companies who are still responsible and all that as well.
Well, you see, there are no companies that are responsible all the way up. You have Network Rail, which allegedly owns the rail infrastructure. The people running the trains are a myriad of other companies, and trying to coordinate between these companies and everybody getting their slice of the fare and everything is amazingly, well, bureaucratic. They were showing one place where they'd put back a connection on a certain route so that you wouldn't have to go when they improved the route, they cut a basically a Y, and you would have to go basically to an intermediate city and then change trains. And they said, well, by putting this leg of the Y back, they would resolve that problem. Well, they put the track back, but in order to get trains scheduled back on it, it would take several months.
Yeah, sounds about right. That it would take a little, the work would be a lot of time and money, and they wouldn't be ready by a certain time to originally said, and all of this. And also there was an idea to have the HT2O, I think it was called, like a really high fast speed train between Birmingham and London, I think it was, yeah. And I believe that recently got scrapped as well, the whole idea. And yeah. It's one that would go on about in the news a lot at times before.
There's massive electrification projects going on too.
Yeah, that's a good point. So a lot of the lines are not actually electric yet. They were doing the lines around here recently, or part of them, electrifying them. So yeah, there's that as well.
And then you have Crossrail, which is effectively extending the Continental Rail Network through Britain.
Which one?
Crossrail.
What's Crossrail?
It is extending the channel through London.
Which tunnel?
Channel.
Tunnel.
Oh, channel. CHUNNEL.
That's what I thought you said, or something like that, yeah.
The tunnel under the channel.
Yes.
Right, the channel tunnel. I'm not sure about that. And the other thing with that, I mean, you got to bear in mind that, I don't know if you follow British politics or how, you probably don't get much of it on your news and facts, whereas we get a lot of the Donald Trump stuff over here. Oh yeah. But I'm sure you've heard of this little thing called, not a little, but like a big thing called, Brexit, which is about to happen, or in some form, or probably, and it's an absolute mess. There's a deal, and they can't agree on it, and the European Commission want this, and then the MPs here can't agree on it. It's an absolute mess. And I assume the Channel Tunnel will get affected as well, you know, soon enough.
Well, yes. For one thing, where are they going to put the customs stations?
Well, yeah, I suppose, yeah. And the border control and all the rest of it, yeah.
Also, England is leaving the EU. I have not heard whether Scotland and Wales have signed on.
No, the thing is, right, the UK is leaving the EU because it's joined together. So that's England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. It's all joined together as the UK, which means the UK is leaving the EU. A lot of the people in Scotland, most of the people in Scotland voted Remain, but regardless of that, they basically have to leave the EU as well because they are part of the UK. And so, yeah, so and that's the problem with Northern Ireland as well, because there's a border there with the actual island, which is in the EU and all that. And then on top of that, we have a little place called, which you might have heard of, called Gibraltar, which is, I've been there. It's a rock, and it's on by the sea, and it's kind of in Spain, really, but they want to be British, so there's slight problems there, but it's mostly the Irish issue.
Well, anywhere where you have a road across the airport is a problem.
Gibraltar, yeah, that's true. You go in through... Yeah, it's true. The road goes through the runway. I remember that.
But both Scotland and Wales have their own legislature, don't they?
They do, but they do to an extent. But then you have the overall UK government who say, like, this is how it is. We are overall all in charge. Yes, you have your First Minister of Scotland and your Welsh First Minister and all this, but you have an overall UK law who says, no, this is how it is. And also, actually, okay, a lot of the people in Scotland, like I said, voted Remain, but actually a lot of the Welsh, despite having a lot of European funding for certain things over there from the EU, actually voted Leave. So, yeah, a lot of those Welsh voted Leave. Most of the Welsh voted Leave, it seems.
Well, what I'm saying is you have once... Britain makes an exit, the Scottish may say, well, we liked the deal before, and we would like to have some self-determination.
The thing with the Scottish is they had a referendum in 2014 for this. You want to leave the UK? And it was no, we'll stay in the UK. And they can't just have another referendum because the Theresa May, in this case, whoever's Prime Minister of the UK, has to basically agree for Scotland to have another referendum to go independent. But people know that if you allow that to happen now, there's a very good chance that Scotland would be yeah, we're leaving the UK. And if they got to leave the UK on top of that, they could potentially join the EU as a new country. But it's an absolute mess, this thing.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying, is that you'd have what Canada had back in the independent Quebec days.
What was that? What did Canada have?
The French-speaking Canadians would like to have seceded from Canada.
No, to make it separate. Yeah.
They should do the same thing that they're doing with Brexit. They're going to have a second referendum on it.
There has been sort of talk about how that could maybe happen, or there's a weird way to sort of undo it, maybe even without having to ask the EU properly, but it's not very likely. And I think this is going to happen in some form, regardless. Plus, if there was a second referendum, more people are educated now about what may happen than they were originally. So it would probably be a Remain vote winning overall, and have to push for a Leave anyway in the Conservative Party. That's an absolute mess.
I think the fundamental question... Oh, sorry.
Actually, what the Scottish can do without leaving Britain is invent Hong Kong.
Invade Hong Kong, is that what you said?
Invent Hong Kong.
I see what you're saying.
It's a special economic district. You do not have to have the entire Scotland to go EU. Just have somebody decide that a certain county or counties are in a special economic district that would like to interface with the EU.
Yeah, but I see what you're saying, but it's a bit you could probably say the same thing for Northern Ireland. But there's so many, there's an actual land border here. That's the other issue with that one. That's the only country in the whole of the UK that actually has a land border with the EU. So yeah, there's a big thing there going on with that one.
Yes, well, then won't the, whenever somebody plays, the Brexit March, Irish eyes are smiling.
No, I think, I didn't quite understand, but I think, a lot of people in Northern Ireland, again, they want to stay in the EU. They don't want to go separate.
No, I'm saying the Republic of Ireland is the nation of Ireland is going to be laughing all the way to the bank because they now are part of the EU, and sort of Britain is going to be sandwiched between French EU and Irish EU.
What, in between both? The thing is, well, people in Northern Ireland some have their Irish passports, which are EU, I think that's one point. And also, a lot of this is about trade and money and companies and big business. So, the biggest trade, Ireland does a lot of trade with UK currently. And also, even Germany does a lot of trade. They sell the cars to Britain and things like this. And it's a lot of it is big business as well, not wanting Brexit to happen because of this. But I think most of the countries would want Britain to stay in the EU, actually. Most people in these EU countries.
Oh, I'm sure. But I'm just saying, the nation of Ireland is going to be an even bigger interface to the EU than right now. Britain itself was connected to the EU. Well, when they Brexit, they're cutting their ties to the French continent connection through France, but people will still want to trade, so the center of gravity for trade could head west
to go through Ireland. Yeah, maybe, but except they would have to have similar trade laws under, because they're both EU states, France and Ireland, they have to basically follow the same laws for the most part, same rules.
I'll be back in a moment, but I will. There's an interesting parallel that I'll mention based on the making of 12 o'clock high.
Making from about 12 o'clock, yeah. Somebody else turned up, I think. Anybody else here?
Yeah, I'm back here. Sorry I had to jump out of the conversation with you about an hour or two ago.
Well, when we talked about UFI, was that? Or
I think it was about immigration in the U.S.
Oh, right, I wasn't part of that one. That was probably the other conversation.
Oops, I guess now's not a time for one of those comments about you all sound the same.
I won't sound the same, I'm from a different country.
Well, back in the days of 12 o'clock high, they were flying B-17s with all sorts of blank firing guns and whatnot loaded aboard across the Atlantic, and they landed in the Azores.
Hold on one sec. Noma, where are you from?
I'm from El Paso, Texas.
Okay, so you sound a bit different, but yeah, the other ones, I agree, they sound pretty much the same because it's an American accent, and I will sound different because I'm from a different country.
Well, yeah, I was saying I thought I had a conversation with you earlier, but maybe you were saying that it was someone else.
Yeah, probably.
And
yeah,
it sounds like someone else.
Let's have this story from Netmine or whoever it was. Carry on.
Sorry.
Well, they, for some reason, weather or whatnot, they had to fly from the Azores to Portugal and land. Portuguese customs was a little upset. But somebody pointed out that going from the Azores to Portugal was a local flight.
Right, yeah, okay.
The thing to have is flights from France to Ireland are going to be EU flights. They're not international.
The planes is another one, yeah. I mean, like, there's like an idea, if there's a hard Brexit, there's no deal, that basically, or maybe this is the old idea, and it can be, it's like, I think more recently it was like, they would be allowed to fly into the EU from the UK, but then they can't go anywhere beyond that, basically. And you can't have, UK airlines can't have flights inside the EU either, going between different EU countries and all this kind of stuff as well. And then in an emergency, I guess there's exceptions to that. This plane is going to crash, so we need to land in the EU and, you know.
I believe the British phrase sticky wicket is going to be very familiar to many people from the EU.
Now, only us Seinfeld watchers.
What was that?
I said just us Seinfeld watchers.
And also, there should be a trade deal with... although I think there was some rule, some might, if it's on the transition thing, UK can't actually make trade deals of its own just yet. With, say, America, or Japan, or China, or whatever, Commonwealth countries, maybe. So they would have some control over the UK if there's a transition period that hasn't just left completely, because it took 2 years of that. And if they go with the current deal, there's less control as well that's being proposed, and it's an absolute mess.
Just wanted to break in to say Happy New Year to people in the Central Time Zone, Midwest United States, me included.
Happy New Year, 50.
Yep, Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, except it's been New Year a few hours already. And it looks like for some reason 2019 is actually allowing America to enter it now as well, as in it hasn't exploded or something. But yeah.
We should, since the time zones, I believe, go across the border, we should also welcome our Canadian friends in the Central Time Zone. Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year, parts of Canada then. And there's no, I don't think there's any Canadians on here at the moment, but they might be listening, some of them. But, they would probably say they're better than the Americans anyway. They are better.
And Happy New Year jingles wherever you are, my favorite British YouTuber.
Probably sleeping at this time.
Actually, I think he's in Prague.
Well, either sleeping then or just waking up if in Prague, yeah.
He may have come home. He was going to be in Prague over Christmas.
Happy New Year from Chicago.
Yeah, Chicago. Which comes up as being a rough city sometimes on these documentaries, but how rough is it really? And crime and things like that.
I'm in the suburbs.
Bears fan.
Well, the criminals are protected by the best gun control laws in America.
What, is it allowed to have?
No honest citizen is allowed. The restrictions on guns in Chicago are very tight, and the murder rate is accordingly quite high.
Archer, are you a Bears fan?
I don't watch sports much, but my wife is a Bears fan.
I should watch a little bit more sports, because I got the Sky Sports stuff at the moment. 3 years under a deal that was okay.
Well, I will note that the Cubs won the pennant by importing a manager from Boston.
Yeah. So I saw something that was sort of interesting today. 2019 is exactly halfway between Y2K and the end of the 32-bit Unix epoch.
So does that mean that we're going to have a doomsday scare again?
Fix that problem.
Everybody's going to be using 64-bit by then, not?
Is this the one where basically 32-bit processors will not know the date and time anymore because of some reason?
Well, the 32-bit timestamp will roll over and it will all of a sudden become 1969 again.
Yeah, 1960. The date and calendar can't go any further. Is that what it is?
Well, actually, if things are declared properly, it should be possible to run 32-bit systems, just that they haven't been able to convert the structures yet.
When will that happen? When will it stop and go back to
2038. January 19th, I think, of 2038.
Oh, so not until 2038. That's the last day. Yeah, you're like, yeah, yeah. I think I remember reading this, but then the whole idea was that a lot of these 32-bit machines will probably not really be around as such anymore by then anyway. So, and if they are, then it's you can just pretend it's 1969 or, you know, use some other device to tell the time and date.
Yeah, I expect it to be about as big of an event as Y2K. That is not really that big of an event.
Y2K was mostly a marketing thing, wasn't it? Like with all these problems and all that, and it didn't happen.
Well, actually...
Oh, yeah, but nothing happened.
I thought that was because a lot of people worked really hard to fix that problem. That's why nothing actually happened.
I think there's something to that, yeah. I mean, I think there would have been some big problems had some work not been done. But I think it was a little bit overblown, too, as well.
Hang on a second. Well, I can't quite think what the Millennium Bug was now and Y2K. But yeah, it was the idea that was those are things were going to go wrong. I can't remember quite now. Mine's gone a bit blank, but remind me.
It was 2-byte ASCII dates rolling over to 00 when a lot of stuff had been programmed only to be 1900 through 1999. They assumed a 19 in front of the year number. So Y2K would have reset everybody's dates to 1900.
Oh, right, so it's like this 32-bit thing. But that would only affect certain servers and things mostly, wouldn't it? Or things that really have to have the right time and date.
Yeah, well, the number of things that have to have the right time and date when they're looking at, access times and whatnot on your computer is substantial. However, if they get the structures right, which is a large if, and start converting, whether it's 32-bit or 64-bit, the structures will be incorporated.
Yeah, I guess.
Well, I think this is one of those things that a lot of companies that still rely on older hardware, because there's a lot of companies out there who build these systems, and then because it works, just leave it alone. So there's a lot of stuff out there that, you know, whether you think that there's still parallel ports and token ring networking going on, there is. It's just not that often, and they're like non-updated systems that, you know, something that some company, some bank or some shop or something owns that they just, it works, so they don't do anything to it, and it is so outdated that there may be some 32-bit servers out there that when this thing goes through, it might actually hit. Granted, by that time, I think 2038, that's kind of a long shot for a lot of them, but, you know, it could be out there.
Well, that's like a lot of your ATMs are still running OS 2. By the way, there is a reverse-engineered OS 2 called Arca OS that is alive and kicking at least 1 foot.
Surely COBOL will be dead by 2038.
You know, everyone thought that it was going to be dead by 2010.
Yeah, I don't think COBOL's ever going to die.
Or Fortran.
Well, hopefully not Fortran.
Let's see, the programming language like COBOL and Pascal, where people have programmed things like, you know, banking software and stuff like that, where some people can still get work doing because there's so many people who have, you know, don't know that type of programming language anymore. And they got to fix these things or update them or whatever.
I'm still a Pascal fan, thank you.
It's slightly different point in a way, but related, I guess. I mean, in the Linux kernel, it's like, you know, I'm seeing an article about how they're like in their 40s now, and it's like, who's going to be the next generation of Linux kernel developers? And it's a program that's got like over 7 million lines of code or whatever now. And so a lot of this, it's a good point. Who's going to be working on various things in say 20 years time? And certain things I believe got dropped as well, or pretty much like even Xorg goes to Wayland because again it was an old legacy program that's complicated and only so many people know how to develop it, so they have to do something different with Wayland.
I thought they gave up on Wayland.
Sorry, say that again.
So I thought they gave up on Wayland.
No, I think they carry on Wayland, aren't they? It's meant to replace Xorg, wasn't it?
Ubuntu
Raymond
gave
is
up.
Going, it's the Ubuntu that gave up.
Yeah, no, yeah. But Ubuntu had Myr, which was their own sort of thing, similar to Wayland to an extent, and whatever. They've given up on Myr, yeah. But Wayland is still going on, as far as I know.
Actually, Myr is still alive and well. It is being...
Oh, yeah, the IoT, wasn't it?
Myr is being refocused as a compositor for Wayland.
Yeah, that sounds right. I think I read that somewhere.
By the way, this is the non-Territon solution. Myr developers would rather switch than fight.
Ouch.
Yeah, the Myr developers are trying to make themselves into the independent Wayland compositor that if you want to put your XFCE or whatever on, come on down.
The debate is that, let's see, Wayland is not needed, SystemD is not needed, and BTFS and all that kind of stuff is not needed. And some people really believe in that and insist on using distros that, you know, don't support these things, basically.
But,
no, I kind of sort of learned timers on SystemD, so now I'm okay with it.
Now, if you're using Duvian or a lot of the, you're finding, it was reported that a lot of the software is rapidly aging because they haven't really got substitutes for SystemD that will allow you to compile things like a modern Firefox.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah.
Now, because SystemD has taken over a large chunk of the Linux universe, it's no longer in a purely in a NIT system or anything. It's becoming a backbone of the kernel, and if you try to have a Linux system without the backbone, you end up with a jellyfish.
Well, like I said earlier, I'm still a Slackware guy, so not only do we not have SystemD, we still don't even have an ITD.
What does Slackware use?
It uses kind of a custom thing that is sort of similar to the BSD RC.D init system.
To be honest, really, I'm not really a developer or whatever anyway, but as a user, I mean, I couldn't really care less about these things as long as it, you know, boots up and all that and it works enough. But I know that some people are totally, they care so much about these things that, yeah.
Well, it's also, users come up with the first question in any OS FAT: can it run my software?
Linux can run most of the like standard software that most people would actually want, and then you could debate that gamers it might not quite cater for, but if you want to use, you know, Firefox and LibreOffice or something and all that kind of stuff, it's absolutely fine.
Well, the question is, how does Slackware run a modern Firefox or LibreOffice or whatnot?
It runs it just fine, as far as I know.
After compiling, yeah.
Well, sure, but I mean, it comes with the distribution. I mean, those things, Firefox and LibreOffice, well, not LibreOffice, Firefox comes with the distribution. LibreOffice you can install, or you can compile with a what they call a Slack build script. It's a script that run the script, it untars the source and compiles it like it needs to, and everything just works most of the time.
Now, how do you get updates?
Well, the packages that come with the distribution are updated, and there's a variety of tools that you can use to grab those and install those. But they are distributed by the distribution as binary packages. A lot of the other packages, though, you have to build yourself. And there's a repository out there called slackbuilds.org. And it's not a repository of binary packages. It's a repository of Slack build scripts that you can use to compile and make packages out of all manner of software that's out there. And there's tools to make doing that easier and so forth, but that's kind of the process.
But you have largely a more, may I say, BSD-style build process, the portage type setup?
Yeah, it's a little bit like that, I guess you would say. It's not quite the same as that, but yeah, there's some parallels there in terms of, yeah, you build the packages from a set of scripts. And then, like I said earlier, the init system is an rc.d. There's an etsy rc.d, and then there's just a bunch of scripts in there that do the init stuff for the various services and so on, which is sort of similar to what BSD at least used to be as well.
So it's a bit like systemd init.
Well, I mean, systemd is this big monolith, as far as I understand. I mean, it's just bash scripts is all it is.
No, I'm saying systemv.
Oh,
System,
yeah.
System 5.
Yes, correct.
Pardon my pronunciation.
But like I say, I still like Slackware a lot on a server where I'm basically running, you know, a handful of services, and I want those services to run and run well. On a workstation where you want all kinds of software and user interface software and stuff, it's a bit challenging, and so that's why I've moved on from the workstation point of view.
So what do you use in your workstation?
I'm using Ubuntu, the XFCE version, so Zubuntu, I guess they call it.
What's interesting with me, and I'm doing Zubuntu, or at least XFCE Ubuntu, is that there appears to be a significant difference between, let's say, the Ubuntu core running whatever desktop and the flavored package. Ubuntu is a lot more than XFCE plus, let's say, Ubuntu server.
Right. The Ubuntu team does a lot of work to try to put their own kind of sauce onto things.
It's your own sort of trim and chrome and styling and, you know, it's a branding, well, you know, branding option thing.
Right. It's not just Ubuntu with XFCE on it, it's Zubuntu.
What I'm going to be fascinated by, and I'm looking forward to the next LTS, is LXQT.
50's been using LXQT recently, haven't you?
I've tried LXQT before, but it was a bit, but it was like, what, 2 years ago or something? But yeah, LXD is being replaced by that, as far as I know.
Yeah, I'm running LXQT right now.
It looks like a basic KDE, I assume, or something like that, yeah?
Well, if you just do the QT, right now it's in transition, but if you do the QT side, it seems to be KDE Lite.
Right, LXQT. Hang on a minute. What do you mean if you just do the QT?
In Ubuntu, when you do LX... QT or LXDE, let's say, on 1804. 1804 is still hybrid GNOME QT. So you can select LXQT in the QT flavor, where everything's not quite translated. In the next long-term edition, I suspect everything will be translated to QT.
Oh, yes. What, you mean how Ubuntu? Well, or even, I suppose even if you have Ubuntu on there, like for example, Firefox is actually made for GTK and other programs as well. But you would be running in that. Is that what you mean?
Well, I'm saying that right now LXQT has some LXDE GNOME components, but those components are being translated or replaced by QT-only component.
Oh, yeah, LXD, I suppose it did use GTK. I haven't used that for ages either. But yeah, that makes sense. They're trying to get rid of the GTK things to be replaced completely by the Qt stuff. And I mean, somebody else was going to say something as well, I think, earlier, and then we said, hold on. But
50, how are you doing on LXQT?
Can't complain. I didn't. It hasn't quite solved the problems I was having with Firefox. I think that may be just the hardware on this machine. I may get out my other laptop and replace it. Replace this eventually as the desktop I'm using all the time, because I don't have that many tabs open in Firefox, and it'll just get worse dog slow, slows the whole system down, and I either have to restart Firefox or I have to restart the whole system.
Now, does that have the default Qt apps like Dolphin and Conqueror and stuff like that?
Conqueror is mostly gone now, isn't it? Isn't really worked on anymore, I thought.
I don't know. I was just trying to come up with some of the Qt apps that I can think of.
Well, I didn't really see a whole lot of, you know, not like when you install KDE, it's not like you automatically got Dolphin or something like that.
Okay.
It's just meant to be a more lightweight desktop interface, I believe, like XSEE or LX, well, okay, formerly LXE if you like, and things like that. Okay, not OpenBox, that's a little bit too lightweight in this context, but yeah.
It sounds like XFCE is going to be filling in the place of the LXDE for low-spec hardware.
Why, you think LXQT is higher spec than XFCE?
Also, Mate is probably okay on most old computers still.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying that XFCE, when you start putting in the richness of the KDE environment and the Qt environment, things fatten up pretty fast.
Right.
By the way, I'm not saying anything against them for fairly recent hardware. It's just that I'm running some dinosaurs.
Said it once, I've said it a thousand times. When it comes to low-spec spec hardware desktops, I've always liked Enlightenment.
The thing with Enlightenment, I mean, I haven't seen it for about a year or two, I think. But I did try it out a bit, you know, and it's got that sort of flashy, blingy type feel, and then also you've got loads of themes for it and so on. And that's just sort of that's the impression I got. So yeah,
I like
that was E17, yeah, E17.
Well, there's about, I think if you go through like Arch, I think there's 21 or 22 out right now. But the thing with I always enjoyed about Enlightenment was just the fact that some of them, like some desktops, give you the ability to configure some of the things. Enlightenment seems to give you the opportunity to configure just about everything to the way you want it to look and the way you want it to feel and the way you want it to act. If you can go into the menus and the settings, then you could probably just get it set up to just look like any other desktop environment without having to add any extra themes or anything like that. It works. It's light. It's very, very lightweight, and it looks really, like you said, it's flashy. It looks really nice. I don't know. I always enjoyed it.
E17. So okay, you said it's E22 or some more recent version now, I'm sure. But going by what I remember, E17 is that it was just seen flashy, and it had the effects and that, but then it kind of wore off, and it felt more like a toy, really, than a serious interface for doing, you know, usual computer things on. And you could debate and say that GNOME Shell has been like that, more so in the past as well, and even now a bit, but I do find that it's more blingy that as well. And then if you want to actually do some, like, proper task on a computer or work or something, then you probably want to run something like FSE or Mate or UC7 possibly, or KDE even, but something with less effects, depending on what you're doing on the computer.
Well, you don't need to have the effects. My point was that you can set up an Enlightenment system to look like...
You can
like,
disable the effects, yeah.
Sure, but you can set it up so it looks like... obviously, it's going to have a harder time looking like KDE, but KDE is kind of tighten some of the way you can set that up to look, but you can make it look like Mate, XFCE, anything else for that matter. But you have the ability to kind of set things up the way you want it to be set up. I mean, it isn't just all flash and whatnot. I don't see why I don't understand the comment of when you want to really get down and do some hard work, you have to go into XFCE or Mate or something like that. I don't understand that comment.
Well, I just am basing this on E17. I haven't used the recent version of Enlightenment. I'm going by what I remember of E17. So, yeah, that's obviously a bit older now anyway. But I remember when I tried it out, it just seemed sort of, it was flashy, and it was a bit, probably more fun than a serious, like, work interface. But, you know, I'm talking about, like, probably something like 2 years ago here, so, you know.
I think you're also, just like classic KDE, it's how much effort into being, to using the tunability that you want to put into it.
Well, it's also, I mean, once you kind of know the system, I can, like, after I first set up a system, I can set up my Enlightenment system to, I don't care whether it's E17 or E22, E21, E19, whatever. I can set it up to the way I like my desktop to be set up relatively quickly, because it's, you know, I usually have some icons on the bottom for the quick for my quick launching things. I usually have them hidden. I know how to set that up relatively quick. And I usually have the top bar being, you know, where my running applications are, taskbar and stuff like time clock, and whether the things are connected are all up on the top. So I could set that up relatively quickly, just maybe because I've been using Enlightenment for so long that, I mean...
I should, in a way, try Enlightenment again, but in this install of Ubuntu I've got on it at the minute, I'm not going to do it because I've had issues where if you keep on putting... I think there's a bug in Ubuntu or something. I need to put my geo or something on there as well anyway. But... if I put certain interfaces on at times, or it has been doing it, it sort of goes wrong, and I end up in the terminal and stuff. So I just leave this mostly as it is for the minute. But yeah, I should give Enlightenment a go in something or the other again, really, because it probably has progressed a lot since E17 anyway, like you seem to be saying.
Yeah, that's what I want to, that's why I really want to dig into boxes, being able to put on relatively pure Linux distros without having to worry about loading things up to compile the guest editions.
VirtualBox? Boxes? Do you mean VirtualBox or?
GNOME boxes.
GNOME boxes.
GNOME boxes. I know that's in there, but I've never used GNOME boxes.
Have you had any more, have you tried using GNOME boxes anymore recently?
I haven't dug into it, and the documentation seems to be Turing complete, but not very detailed.
Seems to be one of those things that you're just going to have to go in and trial and error, trial and error, trial and error, and by the time you're done, we're going to expect you to make us a YouTube video on the proper way to use it.
I would suggest you'll be walking from Provincetown to Newburyport first.
Where's Newburyport?
North Shore.
That sounds like a bike race.
No, that's just walking across Mass Bay.
And say, doesn't the pan? That sounds like the Pan Mass in reverse.
Well, it's relatively straightforward. You just sort of head north northwest.
Well, I'd have to back up about an hour or so to P-Town first, and then start my walk.
Well, yes, but besides, walking across Boston Harbor is going to be pretty tiring.
But the scenery is lovely.
Yes, well, I'm more inner harbor, well, down on the South Shore.
Steve, for some reason we can't hear you, bud. I think are you muted? Steve, your lips were lighting up, but I couldn't hear anything. And I can't tell whether it's you or Bennett that's muted.
I don't see either one of them muted.
Well, I didn't think my vision had gotten that blurry yet.
Yeah, I don't think Steve muted. Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, come take it, turn off, and come back on again. Close it down, come back on. I think he's doing that. Or has done that. Yeah, try and speak again, Steve, if you just close Bumble down and reloaded it. No, it's not. Try again. You might need to do voice wizard again or something. I don't know, it's weird.
Man, you were trying to fight a minute ago.
Or you can do a, even though it's a Linux distro we assume you're on, you can do a, Windows and totally and utterly reboot the computer and come back. And then it might just work, yeah.
You know what's funny is this version of Mumble that I have, every time I log into Mumble, I have to go through the configuration wizard, go through all the settings in there real quick, or when I try to log on, it just won't work.
Every time you load up, you have to do the configuration with the voice. This is a test message. You're talking about that stuff, yeah?
Yeah.
How about now? Can you hear me now?
Hey, there you are.
Yeah, it's the annoying the wizard stuff. And hello, Steve, what was the problem with your speaker, your microphone?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm using a USB headset, and
maybe it freaked out. I just unplugged it and plugged it back in and then restarted Mumble, and now apparently it's working.
Cool.
I'm on a USB headset as well, but I had no problems with this one.
Yeah, I haven't had a problem until now, so who knows, something freaky, I suppose.
A buddy of mine who used to work on the big Honeywell machines, the big 36-bitters, when they were room-filling machines, said broken hardware will do what it wants. And if the hardware decides to be broken, it will be broken.
Indeed. So what I was going to say before is I'm still on the GNOME boxes. I hadn't really been familiar with that. Is that basically just a replacement for Vert Manager? That's what it kind of looks like from the Wikipedia page.
Yeah, it's kind of like a GNOME VirtualBox, but it lets you run things as Netminer. You can describe it better. You can run things better as root. I forgot.
Actually, think of it as a Linux version of VirtualBox.
Isn't it a bit like KVM or something, but with the graphical user interface? I haven't you to use KVM.
Well, yes. Yes, it is, but what I'm saying is, if you think of it as the VirtualBox interface and the setup protocols and everything that you're used to in VirtualBox, but done using Linux tools and Linux environment.
Done the GNOME way using the GNOME tools. That makes sense, yeah.
Right. I mean, I'm very familiar with QEMU, KVM, and libvirt. It's just I usually use, there's a GUI application called Vert Manager that is kind of part of the whole libvirt thing
I've had a Vert Manager somewhere as well.
Right, and so this looks like kind of a replacement for that, which is cool.
Well, if you think of it as a wrapper for all those tools, Vert Manager may be another wrapper.
Yeah. It's a bit like they got GNOME games as well, haven't they, to allow you to play games with their graphical user interface or whatever.
Well, Vert Manager is getting a little bit kind of long in the tooth, if you will, or it's not very pretty and not very user-friendly by today's standards, and so I'm guessing they're addressing that here.
Also, the reason I call it VirtualBox for Linux is that it seems, again, I haven't booted my first machine with it. It seems to have a lot of the connectivity stuff and, you know, maybe display management and stuff like that that you get with a VirtualBox and interconnection stuff and whatnot, so that it's a much more painless experience.
Does the networking work easier?
I'm just going to quickly say this as a half joke. It doesn't matter because VirtualBox for the win, yeah.
Well, the thing I like about libvirt and Vert Manager and stuff is that, I mean, I have several servers that run virtual machines, and I can fire up Vert Manager on my local workstation and access virtual machines running on the server, which I don't know if you can do that with VirtualBox, and I suppose you probably can with this GNOME desktop, GNOME boxes thing.
That's exactly what GNOME boxes' big deal is, its ability to reach out and touch other machines and other services on distant machines. Again, I haven't worked this stuff out. This is going to be a learning cliff system.
Yeah,
but
that sounds interesting. But in a way, regardless of that, although that sounds very interesting, if you've got other machines, I mean, you know, it's like VirtualBox is generally people's like. You say something, you can do virtual machine, you'll go VirtualBox to the Linux user. Or you might just say VMware if you're a bit more old school as well. You might go, yeah, there's a VMware player or something as well. People don't really go, yeah, okay, you can do a virtual machine where you've an operating system inside an operating system. You can use this, GNOME boxes, like, you know, no one really says that on the support channel, do they? Or you can run this KVM thing, or you can run Vert Manager, or you can run, it's, you know, it'll be VirtualBox, at least in Ubuntu and stuff, it'll be VirtualBox recommended. But these other things are good as well, of course, that they're there and that you can use them for certain things you can't do with VirtualBox even. You just gave an example, it seems.
Well, what GNOME boxes seems to be is a way to do VirtualBox type stuff without the many interface layers that makes VirtualBox easy to use. I mean, you know, the VirtualBox environment is luxurious, but it also requires, first you have to have the extensions, the extension pack, and then you have to have the client extension.
Well, the extension pack is only for some extra features in VirtualBox that are actually proprietary otherwise. And also, this DJ Terry, whatever he's called, just turned up, but he had a weird noise trying to do the microphone, I think. Try again. Let's see. Try your microphone again, I guess. Well, that sounds odd. I think you need to do the mumble voice configuration again, or reload mumble or something like that. Nope, it's still squeak squeak for some reason. Something's wrong there.
You've got the chipmunk setting turned on.
Is there actually a chipmunk setting, or is that a joke?
Either that, he's got to feed his mumble a banana.
Hey guys, I think I'm going to bug out. I've got some things to do in the morning, and so I'm going to call it quits for tonight. It's been good talking to everybody.
Happy New Year. Yeah, Happy New Year. I'll go in about an hour and a bit as well, but not just yet.
All right, catch you all later.
I meant to ask, was Steve one of the new Mintcasters?
No.
No. Joe is, though.
Well, we got Winnie here. I just wanted to say good work picking up the mantle. It's still a good show, and you guys make it good and better.
Thank you.
Picking up the mantle. It's still a good show, and you guys make it good and better.
Thank you. I'm glad people are enjoying it.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.